You're listening to My White Belt, the best jiu-jitsu podcast in the world. Enjoy.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of My White Belt. I'm your host, Jim Trick, and this is a special edition. This is our first in a series of what I'm calling Origin Stories. As you know, I am sponsored by Origin Maine and Jocko Fuel. They make the ghees that I train in, and they make the supplements that I drink. They also make the boots that I wear and the jeans that I wear and the hoodies that I wear and the t-shirts that I wear, all up in the great state of Maine. When I started the My White Belt thing, I hoped eventually that I would have a sponsor, and sort of my long-term dream goal was that someday I would get to work with the people at Origin. And they were the first people to say, yeah, yes, you're an affiliate, you're in, we want you to do this, we want to partner with you on this. And as a result, you have been incredibly generous and have supported My White Belt by buying Origin products and using the discount code TRICK10, which everybody at my academy laughs at me about. So today, our guest is John Milan. John works closely with Pete and Jocko, and he is actually the first person ever hired by Origin when it was just a dream and it was in Pete's basement. And he's this really interesting guy. We've gotten to know each other a bit. He's a fly fisherman. He's a hunter. He is. He's lost a bunch of weight. His faith is important to him. He and I just immediately, you know, you have a conversation with somebody and you just feel like you've been friends forever. That's John Milan for me. And he's also a BJJ, a long time BJJ brown belt who has a story around that. So I'm really excited to bring this. To you. And we're going to talk a lot about Origin because it's an origin story. And my hope and goal is that as we go forward, I would occasionally, maybe once every couple of months, do an episode that highlights somebody that's either really connected to Origin or somebody who works for the company up in Farmington. I'm not going to talk a whole lot here at the front end, but I'm glad that you're listening. Go to mywhitebelt.com, sign up for My White Belt Wednesdays, go to originmaine.com, Jocko Fuel, use discount code TRICK10, buy some stuff, support My White Belt. I'm glad you're here. I hope you enjoy this conversation with BJJ Brown Belt and first Origin employee, John Milan. John Milan, welcome to the My White Belt Show. Thank you so much for being my guest for our first ever Origin Stories edition of the My White Belt Show.
I appreciate you having me.
Brother, I'm so stoked that you are here, and we'll get into the details of our friendship as we dive into this. But because, and I'm not saying this to brag, though I'm pretty proud of it, the show is listened to in over 80 countries. And you live in one of my favorite places in the world. So for the person listening in Japan or Australia or Brazil or Dublin, can you please, in your words, describe Maine? What is Maine?
So Maine, we are the Northeast, United States. We are the first ray of sunlight in the United States. Every morning hits Maine first in Cadillac Mountain, Bar Harbor, Maine. But we are cold weather. You know, it's when people picture, we have moose, we have tons of snow. You know, we are rugged America over here.
It's magnificent. Are you raised in Maine?
Yep. I was born on the coast. So I grew up with, like, lighthouses and lobster buoys, mm-hmm. but moved to Western Maine where it's more mountains. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, we have everything. It's beautiful here.
Tell me if you can relate to this. Anthony Bourdain, on one of his, he used to do these adventure things where he'd go all over the world. I can't remember what the, I think it was called No Reservations with Anthony Bourdain. He would literally go all over the world to these exotic places. And for one episode, he went to Maine and he had guys that had a house in the country that looked like a camp, but those men also had a camp an hour away from their house to quote unquote get away from it all.
That is a main thing, is everyone goes, we go up to camp. Doesn't matter where it is, you're going up to camp and you just go out in the woods. We have a camp that you can only access in the winter by snowmobile. So you have, there's no power, there's no nothing. You just snowmobile down in, and it's right on this gorgeous lake. We'll ice fish all weekend, but you have gas lamps and, you know, wood stoves.
So ice fishing, what are your other core outdoor activities before we get into our favorite indoor activity?
So outdoor, I'm an avid hunter, fisherman up here being in the Northeast. So I'll fish, you know, in the ocean, or I'll fish, you know, fresh water. You know, we'll hunt birds, ducks, geese, deer, moose, you know, all that stuff up here in Maine. And
does a significant amount of your family's food come from what you hunt?
No,
no. So you're not that good at it.
No, it's a good chance. Yeah, I'm not very good at it. I'm not gonna lie. Fish I could do, but you know, I have a small farm, and we did raise a lot of our own meat. So we did process chickens and pigs. I have four horses, so it's, you know, taking care of all those critters all year round is another chore. And I'll tell you, farm boy strong is a thing. You know?
Yeah. Well, I used to speak at I used to be like a Bible camp speaker up in Maine, and you know, you'd wind up, you get 80 teenagers together for a week of camp, there's going to be some kind of wrestling that's going to happen. And you'd have these kids that don't look like anything beating the stuffing out of much bigger guys. And be like, what's his story? And raised on a farm, and that's it. Like, it's nuts. So this is our first edition of Origin Stories. Obviously, I love Origin. How many years have you worked for Origin? You were the first employee?
So I was Origin's first employee. It was Pete and I in his basement way back in the day. So that would have been, I think it's like late 2011, early 2012. So the company started in 2011 with Pete. And that was when, you know, when it took off. He said, I need someone to help me, but it's in my basement. So I had worked with him for years at his last company, which is a graphic design company. And he said, I need someone I can trust in my house with my family all day. You're kind of the only one that fits the bill. So that's where we started.
And was he training? How long was he training jiu-jitsu at? He must have, because you started a gi company. So
kind of I can give you the backstory from there. Was what happened is Pete and I worked, Pete owned a company that was a graphic design firm in Farmington, where Origin is also. And in 2008, we had the economy collapse. And the first thing most every company cut was their marketing budget. And so Pete ended up having to sell his marketing company. And he took the money from when he sold the company, and just his wife told him, you know, compete, go do as much jiu-jitsu as you want. But it was like a year or two, if you aren't where you want to be, then get your resume together and you can get a job. Well, in that time, he won the pro trials in Montreal as a brown belt. And that was back when the brown and black belts were the same division.
Wow.
Yeah. So he beat all the black belts and made it to go over to Abu Dhabi, and then made it to the top eight.
This guy from Maine.
It's
like, where is he even training? Where the heck is he even training? You're in Farmington. Like, listen, friends, I've been to Farmington and it's beautiful and it's great. And you can go watch the colors of the foliage as the seasons change. And it's great. But it is not the place that you think of when you you're thinking of where can I train jiu-jitsu at a high level. You don't typically think Farmington, Maine, especially in 2011.
True story. So what back then when so Pete and I were trying to travel to find any jiu-jitsu that we could. And at that time, I think there was only like three black belts in the entire state of Maine. So we ended up going all the way down to Portland, Maine, which is kind of like the biggest city in Maine. It's about half.
Do you guys even consider that Maine?
No, that's northern Massachusetts.
Perfect.
So, but that's, you know, Maine consists of about 1.5 million people, and half of that is in the greater Portland area.
Okay.
So we would travel down there, and there was one black belt named Alexei Cruz that we were training with. And he had said, you know, I have this really good friend of mine you need to meet that they call him Dedeco. It's Andre Dedeco Almeida.
Yeah.
Right. And him and me hit it off big time. So they became instant best friends.
Did you and Pete start training at the same time?
We started training the same exact week. And so I ended up moving away when the company shut down and there was no jiu-jitsu where I moved.
Where'd you go?
So I went over to the back to the coast.
I see.
I had a newborn and a one-year-old boy at the time and started trying to start my own graphic design business. So when Pete called me up, I had to make the call of, do I continue with my business or move back to Farmington in this new business that we knew nothing about? And my wife and I had to have a really hard talk, and we really liked the Farmington area. So we decided to move back.
How does just a little inside world, because right now people are listening all over the world that they have things that they would like to do. They have places that they'd like to move to, and they have dreams that they would like to chase. And they just might not be in a situation where they even feel comfortable broaching that conversation with their partner. So when you sit down to have that kind of conversation with Mrs. Milan, what does that look like?
I honestly thought she didn't want to move. But it was one of those things that when we both brought it up, we realized how much we both missed the Farmington area. And it was just something that was unspoken. I thought it was going to be, you know, okay, let's just, I'm going to air this out and, you know, I'll listen to what she has to say. And, you know, she's an amazing wife. She'll listen to what I have to say. And when we said it, you know, from both our hearts, we're like, we know this is what needs to happen.
The ancients once said, you have not because you ask not. And how often do you get in a situation with your wife or just in life where you're like, you think something is so out of reach, and then you finally have the courage to ask the question or walk through that door or walk through that gate, and you realize that waiting did not serve you?
Oh, 100%.
We hear that as a jiu-jitsu story all the time, too. I posted about it this week. For the person there, they've just, I don't know, maybe they did the karate lessons when they were kids and they did this, that, and the other thing. And they just dream. They dream of doing jiu-jitsu, but they're terrified that it's going to be like a UFC match.
100%.
But walking through that door for the first time. So I just want to, I love that she was willing to move back to Farmington. Farmington's a great place. I do want to just get back to, as it relates to jiu-jitsu, your origin story for training. So your early days were in Portland. Was that like where your trial class was? Did you have to go all the way down?
What we did is we actually had a school in the Farmington area. that, but it was being taught by a purple belt.
Because
there was no real jujitsu, speak of being taught at high levels. So if you wanted to go high level, you had to travel. But for our weekly classes, there was a purple belt. And without getting into the weeds, there was jujitsu politics that happens at schools, and we ended up, Pete decided to start his own academy in Farmington. So there was just a handful of us training in the basement of the graphic design studio. I literally would have my chair set up against the back of the mats. People would be training and kick my chair while I was working on the computer. And that's when we started.
And what prompted you to even try jiu-jitsu?
It was like, most people back in the late, 2009 to probably 2007-ish, that when UFC was really taking off and everyone's like, oh, what's this jiu-jitsu thing? I love watching the UFC, but I really don't want to get hit in the head. So it was so that was, we watched BJ Penn, we watched, Damian Maya, and I was like, man, there's really something to this jiu-jitsu.
And you just said, let's try this. Let's do this.
It was actually Pete took a class on Monday and said, came in and he's like, John, I've been doing this. And like anyone else, after they went to their first class that was hooked, he's like, oh, man, it was so good. He's like, I grappled, and he's like, I got this position. I don't know what it was called, but someone grabbed my arm and locked me up. It was crazy. He's like, you got to come try it. So I went to the class that was on Wednesday. So I went, Pete went, took one class. I was there for the second class.
And back then it probably would have been all gi, right? At that point,
it was all gi back then.
And what was, class one, what were your thoughts?
I'll never forget. There was a woman that was a nurse that was a blue belt, and she absolutely destroyed me the first class. And, just if anyone for reference, I'm a 5'11". 235 pound dude. So to be destroyed, you have one of two options. You can either be humbled and say, I need to learn this, or your ego kicks in and you're like, I don't know. And you just step away. And I was humbled. I needed to come back for more.
And were you nervous going in, just out of curiosity?
Oh yeah. 100%.
Yeah. Isn't it funny?
Yep.
Why do you think we're so? Why do you think we're so nervous walking in for the first time?
I think it's because a lot of people, they want to do it, but you don't know what to expect. Like, what's the etiquette? What's am I going to do something that offends someone? You just don't know what to expect. It's the unknown.
We had a new guy who did his trial class the other night, and we have people roll right out of the gate. And, by roll, I mean, I'll take a trial class white belt and put him in the clothes guard of a good blue belt and just say, hey, just play back and forth. Just play back and forth a little bit. And this kid, he's probably 6'2", and he's in okay shape, horrible cardio. Sorry, Jake, you're going to get there, pal. But, He had his two first classes last week and threw up in the parking lot after both of them, but he's going to do great. But he's asking the question while he's rolling. He's like, how hard can I grab him? And I said, well, if you're asking that question, you're probably going to be fine. Mm-hmm. If you're concerned about it, but just in terms of the butterflies, isn't it funny to see guys that in other parts of their lives, they seem so confident and maybe they're incredibly successful. And then they walk into an academy for the first time and it's a very different,
a
very different version.
And one thing I'll tell you that no one told me when I started is that jiu-jitsu is unlike any sport, that you can travel to anywhere in the world. Like I played football, I played baseball, I played basketball. I met people that played football, baseball, and basketball in other places. And they're like, oh, cool. Jiu-jitsu, instantly your family to that person. And that's unlike any other sport.
Have you traveled a bunch to other academies?
Yes.
And have you ever had a bad experience? And be honest, I'm really curious.
I mean, there's, I wouldn't say I've had different varying, I wouldn't know how to say it, but
maybe like intensity level
experiences at different academies, but I wouldn't say any of them have been bad.
Okay. Intensity, like maybe it's the intensity is a little different.
Like,
that
well, going to a, it's different between going to like a competition school versus going to a school where it's people that a majority of them are in their 40s, 50s, and 60s and are doing this just to stay fit and still have to go to work tomorrow. You know, it's a different thing.
Did you compete?
I competed at Purple Belt.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, what was that like?
I podiumed. I got third at the Boston Open when I was Masters One in the 220 division.
Wait, how old are you?
I am 42 now.
All right, I'm 52. But we're so old. It's so old. It's a couple of bald guys with beards trying to do our best. So how has it changed your life? How has training, and this is kind of like, we're sort of like selling jiu-jitsu with this question to people who haven't started, or to the person who's like in their first year and they're really discouraged and they want to quit. How has it changed your life?
Jiu-jitsu is my therapy. Is that, you know, if my wife can tell when I haven't trained in a while, and she's like, you need to get on the mats. Cause you know, I get in my own head. I'm thinking about work. I'm thinking about projects I need to do at home. I'm thinking about everything that's going on. But when I'm doing jiu-jitsu, the only thing I can think about is jiu-jitsu.
What is it about this thing? Why do we love this so much? And why do we all describe it as therapy? Cause it is for me as well. When you break it down to its details, what do you really love about it?
I think there is an endorphin release when you're training, but it's almost like an endorphin release during a chess match, is that you're trying to learn the response. You know, it's almost like learning a language. And when you start, someone's talking to you and you have no clue what they're saying. And so you have no response to anything. It's just, okay, I'm here, I'm showing up. And as you start learning the language of give and take, it starts becoming more and more fun.
What kind of a white belt were you?
Oh, I was that super heavy. I wouldn't say I was thrashy, but I was trying to pressure pass. I was smash pass, you know, just grab, you know, shoot one arm under, hold the pressure down and try to pass.
Yeah. So a lot of laying your gigantic body.
Yep.
Now we just kind of like have gotten to know each other over the last couple of weeks, and the overlap is incredible. We're both New Englanders. We're both men of faith. We're both obsessed with jiu-jitsu. And kind of like this list just keeps on going for us. But one of the other things that we have in common is that you were a chunkamunka.
I was a while there. 100%. Huh? I'm glad you said it too, because I was like, that was one of the things we really connected on. Is that
yeah?
So I got injured, and I tore the tendon that holds my kneecap on. I tore my patella tendon.
And how did you do it?
I was out duck hunting.
Oh, duck hunting.
I was out duck hunting, and I fell. I was in mud, and when I fell down, I thought I was going into the mud, but there was a sharp pointy rock right under the mud. Oh, and shot right up and ripped my patella tendon.
Did you cry?
I saw white. So my son, who was at the time 10 years old, was with me, and I instantly, like, I thought, I'm like, okay, if I get hurt, how am I going to take care of him? You know, I was like, I just got to be able to get back. And it was one of those things. I've trained, and you know, you you get injured, and it's one of those things that takes you a little bit to realize how injured you are. I trained jujitsu the next day.
Still, answer the question. Did you cry?
Visiting.
Did you cry?
I didn't.
Okay, good. That's fine. I wanted you to say yes so that I could call you a baby.
I 100%. If my eyes may have watered naturally, I'm not ashamed to say if I cried, but
how did you train the next day?
So we had a guy come in, and Pete, you know, I said, yeah, I hurt my knee, but I didn't realize how bad. And he's like, John, I really want you to work with this white belt that's a Navy SEAL that's visiting. And I said, okay. So I went to kneel, and I realized I could not put my knee down at all. It just instantly shooting pain. Oof. Up my whole leg. So I started from combat base the whole time. And the guy thanked me and said, oh, that was great. And I was like, oh, okay. Yeah. And I need to go get this checked out. And then, so it was like a week later, I went in and they said, yeah, you have a torn patella tendon.
And how long ago was this?
So this would have been, this was just pre-COVID. So it would have been like 2019-ish.
Okay. And then, so how long, so walk us through, I want to know about the injury, the recovery, and you turning into a fatty boomalatty.
So what I use that as an excuse when I said, you know, you can't train, but I kept eating as if I was training and as if I was working out and as if I was doing everything else. And I wasn't jumping on the scale. So I went from probably 235 pounds. And when I got to my biggest, I still refused to jump on a scale. And so I started working out, and I could tell I was losing weight, and I was starting to train again. And the first time I jumped back on a scale, even after I lost weight, I was 318 pounds.
Dang, son.
Yeah.
That is not a small John Milan.
No.
All right. So just because I'm a former fat guy, walk me through what you ate to get that big. And how awesome was it?
It was pretty good. But I mean, it was one of those things.
It was pretty good.
Everything was delicious. But it was one of those things that when you're working in a factory, you just run over and you grab what's convenient. You go, I'm going to go run down to McDonald's. I'll grab a couple double cheeseburgers and a chicken sandwich. I'm going to grab the fried chicken, or, you know, anything like you're working out and still burning everything. And also at this point, I'm, you know, late 30s, almost 40. Your metabolism isn't the same as when, you know, when I started training at 25 years old.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Were you a skinny guy back then?
I've never been a skinny guy. I've always been built like a linebacker. I was probably, you know, like I said, 5'11", and I competed at 220. So I was a pretty solid 220.
Are you a snacker? Can you put back are you chips? Are you candy? What do you love?
I'm actually not a candy guy. And I thank God for that. But
me
I am
too,
I'm a savory guy. I do like chips or anything like that. So
pizza is killing me right now.
Oh, 100%.
Pizza is killing me because I want it. I literally want it all the time. I've come to some realizations. There's a lot of stuff that just doesn't taste good. Like McDonald's, I never need to eat that kind of thing ever again.
100%.
But from literally where I'm sitting at my place in Massachusetts, I have within a half a mile, I have five great little pizza places, all different. And I never ever get tired of it. And I'm working hard to stay off of it. How long were you off the mat?
So that injury, they had told me if I babied it and didn't push my leg, I could be back within 12 months.
Oh,
and if I pushed it, you know, too hard, it would be about 18 months.
Ugh.
And I'm an idiot. I pushed
Dude, you lost a year and you pushed it hard because you're a moron. Sorry, your words.
No,
idiot.
100%.
I'm just kidding, dude.
No. It's at the factory where, You know, we say, you know, I was moving rolls of fabric and this and that. And I could have asked people to come and help, but I'm like, no, I'm going to do this. I've got to move bales of hay for my horses. And I'm not the type that asks for help. You know,
why are we like this? What the hell is wrong with us? That A, we're terrified to walk into jiu-jitsu, but we won't tell anybody how scared we are. And we're too dumb to rest when a medical professional says you got to rest. And then when we finally kind of do rest, we don't really rest. We push through and we don't ask for help. Like, what's our deal? What is the problem?
I 100% agree with that. It's, you know, I didn't feel well. And Amanda, Pete's wife, was like, John, you know, you kind of look like you're coming down with something. You should, go take some rest and get it checked out. And I said, all right. So I went, got a doctor's appointment at noontime. Turned out I had double pneumonia. And the doctor goes, you aren't acting nearly as sick as you are. They sent me home and said, do not move for 2 weeks.
Dude, I don't know if I still want to be. I don't know if I want to be friends with you. You might be a little too dumb for me to hang with. I'm totally kidding. I am as dumb as you. I'm a 52 year old guy who just did like double classes this morning and rolled and like. Literally, my body hates me right now, but somewhere deep inside, I feel like I did something good for myself.
So go for it.
Were you depressed? Did you get depressed?
Oh, 100%. And it's an emotional loop where you are upset that you let your weight go. And then you get more upset that you're upset. And then you eat more because you're upset. And then you think, oh, I need to do something, but you're still upset with yourself. So it's just a cycle that you have to break out of.
This idea of discipline equals freedom, which is a phrase that's important to both of us and has been central to Origin over the years. Discipline really does equal freedom though, doesn't it?
Oh, 100%. 100%. That's words to live by.
And what's the balance between the feeling, you know, the feeling of feeling depressed and eating out of depression and, you know, out of part of you probably felt like you had a little bit of a license to let yourself go because, oh, poor me, I'm injured, so I'm going to eat all this crap. But when did discipline kick in? What did it look like? And then how long did it take for the freedom to show up?
So, like I said, I have two boys that are right now, they're probably, I think they're just about 12 and 13. So this would have been, say, 3 or 4 years ago. So they're like, you know, 8 and 9-ish. And I'm outside playing with them and I'm getting winded. You know, it's like, oh, they want to go out hunting. And it just was, you know, oh, let's, you know, I'm not, you know, I can see all the red flags going off of I'm not being the best father I could be.
Yeah.
And that was,
that's a kick in the ass.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So one of the things that I talk about a lot is the relationship between our feelings and our values. And I've written about it. I've talked about it a bit, but it's like all of the feelings of desiring laziness and food and pity all go out the window when it starts impacting your relationship with your children and what you're able to do. And what you realize is that you actually have values, deeply held values that are centered around the kind of dad you want to be. And
what was your trigger? What was your moment when you realized?
So, I mean, man, I had completely given up. I mean, I had complete, I was 430 pounds. I had gastric bypass surgery. I got down to 270, but then within 3 years, I was back up to 400 pounds. And it was just totally embarrassing. And I completely gave up. And when I say I completely gave up, I mean, I said, screw it. I ate whatever I want and I just bought bigger pants. You know, and it was funny because every time I would buy bigger pants, people would go, "You look good. Are you losing weight?" And I'd go, "I don't know. I'm trying real hard." And what I meant was, I was trying really hard to get over to the Big and Tall store a couple of towns away so that I could cover my fat ass with a bigger pair of pants. But I had, you know, so I was 430, got down to 270. And then within 3 years was back up to around 400 pounds because I just hadn't done my personal work. And the other thing was, I can see over your left shoulder that you have a copy of Extreme Ownership. And the concept behind that book is sort of, you know, I had some divine intervention. Jesus showed up for me in some very, very unique ways. I'll tell you about some other time. But I stopped blaming other people, John. I stopped blaming other people. I stopped blaming my dad. I stopped blaming the bullies. I stopped blaming a million things. I stopped blaming my ex-wife. I just stopped blaming people. And when you get past blaming other people, it's amazing what you're left with. I was like, this is my life. This is my body. This is my mouth. I'm putting the food in this body that I choose to put in it. And as long as I blame other people, I'm just going to be a fat bastard. I'm going to be a fat, broken dude who's just never going to get anywhere. And I mean, thank God. And I'll also say this, like, I don't know how you, so actually this might be a little different for you. So you lost, you're a 4-stripe brown belt. So congratulations, bro.
So we technically don't do stripes, but I've been a brown belt for years. So,
okay. All right. Why no stripes?
Just something we don't do at our academy.
Do you wish you did?
Now, dude, my belt just holds my gi closed.
Dude, I love getting a stripe. I'm not a stripe. I'm not a stripe whore. And we've talked about it a lot on the show. I like getting a stripe. But I'm with you. So, all right. So you're a brown belt and you've been a brown belt for how long?
About 4 years. Cause I got injured when I was a brown belt.
All right. So you lost that year.
Yes.
Do you want to talk about your friends who got their black belts?
Sure.
Yeah. So
it was one of those things that, Pete, you know, is my instructor as well, you know, my friend, and, you know, is the owner of Origin. So he came to me, and I would say as a friend, and said, just so you know, all the guys that I had come up with that we started, you know, as white belts together. He said, I'm giving them all their black belts, but I just wanted to give you a heads up. You know, you're not getting yours. And as much as I wanted to be hurt, I wasn't.
But dude, can we just talk about, let's talk about this. Because if that was me, I would both simultaneously agree with my instructor and I'd be so sad and pissed and all those other things.
100%. That's exactly.
So you were a little, okay.
I was upset, but I think I was more upset at myself because, like you said, I hadn't taken Extreme Ownership early enough.
Yeah.
That I look back and it was me making excuses going, well, I really don't have to train tonight. I'm still injured. Well, my back, this or that, you know, I'll get back into it.
We're going to have people when we do these origin stories episodes, I want to have all kinds of people that are part of Origin, but I'm psyched that we get to start with you because our stories are so similar. And this idea of extreme ownership. Here's what I keep coming back to. So you and I are both men of faith, and we both believe in God, and we both believe that there's nothing that we can hide from God. And we also believe that there's nothing that we can do that's going to make God stop loving us. Right. Thank God. We believe that. That's sort of the backbone of our lives. This podcast is take what you like, leave what doesn't work for you. And I'm not here to win converts or have you come to my church or join my club. That just happens to be our story. One of the things about jiu-jitsu and Origin ex Jocko Fuel is there's nowhere to hide. You don't need to hide. On jiu-jitsu, you can't fake jiu-jitsu. And the sort of thing with Origin is, listen, we live in a world where everything that we buy and consume is made someplace else. We don't want that. I want the guy who lives down the road from me. Listen, if I can get the guy who lives down the road from me to make jeans for me, those are the jeans I want. If I can get the guy who lives down the road, if I can go to the cobbler and have him make boots, I want, those are the boots that I want. And ultimately, Origin and jiu-jitsu and your life and my life are the result of saying we're getting past our bullshit.
100% agree.
And dude, what a gift that we get to be a part of this. Like, can you believe our lives?
If you had told me, you know, if you had told 25-year-old John that, you know, you're going to work at a jiu-jitsu gi company developing jeans and boots and all that and training jiu-jitsu, I would say you're full of crap.
I listen to some podcasts, dude. I listen to some podcasts and I fast forward through the ads.
Yep.
Do you?
Oh, yeah, 100%.
I fast forward
the first 30 seconds. You just click skip till you hear him start the podcast.
Yeah, I listen to Mark Maron sometimes. I listen to some podcasts and I hate the ads. And I'm sure that people fast forward through my ads sometimes too. But I just gotta say, every Origin gi I have, it was made by my neighbors. It's made by people who live, you know, two states away. I've been to the store, you know. One of these days you're going to invite me to the factory and I'm going to get a tour. We're going to hang out. But, you know, and I'm wearing, I talked about them last week. I'm wearing American Bison boots that I've got these ridiculously wide feet. And I just feel like the products, the brand, the philosophy, the jiu-jitsu, and then owning our behavior so that we don't have to live in these fat, out of shape bodies. And I ask this question a lot, and you know, at the heart, not to answer the question I'm about to ask you, but at the heart, I think is just getting past our bullshit and deciding that we're not going to be phony people who live phony lives and use phony garbage products that are made in countries that we're never going to go to and made by people who hate their jobs, right? So for you, for the guy who is fat, laying on his couch, eating garbage food, and everything that he owns comes from Walmart, you know, mm-hmm. What do you have? What do you have to say to this person? And maybe that person has even given up on faith. Maybe they've given up on the life that maybe they've given up on the foundation that they were raised with in their life.
Well, I mean, that's, you know, that's a great question. I think that person, you know, you look at them and you say, you know, first off, you need to hold yourself accountable. If you are willing to hold yourself accountable on your weight, saying, I need to change, start with the small cornerstones. And then now, if I know not everyone can afford Origin stuff, people look at it and go, it's expensive. But when anyone comes up to the factory, and I'll show people through the factory, and you see all these families, you see, you know, all the people, and they go, I get it. I get it. You know, American made, oh, I bought American made is something. But when you say, I just made it so that that person can buy their kid a birthday present, you know, that they can support that family, and you did it. It wasn't us making the product that made it so that that person could support their family. It's you buying it that actually supported it.
And the thing is, but it's better. And people are, I don't know how people are going to respond, like, because now this is like going to turn into an origin ad, but dude, it's better. It's better. The jeans are better. The boots are better. And at the end of the day, it's a values based decision make. Listen, we're all carrying around iPhones, right? We know that iPhones are bad for people. We know that they're convenient and they're great in 8 million ways. And I'm glued to mine way more than I want to admit or should be. And so let's all just concede that we're all using these iPhones because in our minds, the technology outweighs the damage that we're doing to people's lives in countries that we're never going to go to. Now, when Origin starts making a cell phone, I'll buy one. It'll be expensive and I'll buy one. The O phone, it's going to be great. I can't wait. But apart from that, if I can spend a little bit more money and buy a Gi, if I can, that I love, that the quality is great. And if I can buy a pair of jeans that aren't that much more than other jeans. And in some cases they're, listen, man, I got some fancy friends down here in Massachusetts that pay way more than Origin dollars for their jeans. And I don't look any different, but there's this thing about buying American that I have found isn't just for Americans. There are people all over the world who want to buy American. There are people all over the world who want to buy products that are A, top quality, and B, made by people that are treated well and paid well and love their jobs. Right?
Like 100%. And I've actually had friends from other countries that have said American made is a status symbol. It's almost like when people say, oh, it's an Italian suit, you know, it's quality. If you say, oh, geez, these are American jeans, these are American boots, it still means something in other countries to be like, oh, that's a quality product.
Yeah, I know. We've kind of lost the plot a little bit. I don't get why we're so willing to buy stuff from China. I don't get it. I don't get why we are. How did that happen? Did the heat just get turned up on us slowly like the frog in the frying pan?
So a lot of it happened. We got desensitized back in the mid 90s. During the NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. And you basically overnight, we sent a lot of our manufacturing overseas when we got rid of all the tariffs.
Right.
And so that it was instantly right after that, you could buy the American made jeans for, you know, $50. Or you could buy the just as nice Chinese made ones at the time, or just a little bit less for $10 to $15 because they weren't paying for labor on anything. And people just said, well, I can buy three pair, you know, at that price.
I feel like, you know, what does a man gain what does it profit a man to gain the whole world but lose his soul?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have my guitars. One of my guitars was made here in Marblehead. Two of them were made in Tacoma, Washington. And my most recent one was made in Pennsylvania. And I love knowing that my guitars were made there. I have a Thomas & Thomas fly rod that was made in Massachusetts. It's just a gorgeous fly rod. I have sunglasses from Randolph Engineering that are made in Randolph, Massachusetts. Dude, hoodies, t-shirts, geese. Jeans, boots, leather kettlebells, which I think are, you know, I don't know about a leather kettlebell. You ever work out with a leather kettlebell?
Uh-huh.
I just feel like there's this way. I feel like we have this opportunity as people who are compelled to jujitsu, living that life off the mat of saying, this is going to be real. And maybe this is a little bit harder. Maybe it's more work. Maybe it's not the most convenient thing because we can't run down to the store yet and get this stuff, but we're going to do the rightest thing. We're going to do the rightest thing with our dollars. We're going to do the rightest thing with our bodies as it relates to jujitsu. We're going to have the best attitudes that we can possibly have. And then just be honest about it. Just be honest about the price that we're paying on a million levels and whether or not it's worth it. And for you, as it relates to like your career with Origin, I mean, what's it like for you to have watched this company over the last decade turn into what it turned into?
It's been amazing. It's, you know, if, you know, like I said, being employee number one. So for the first couple of years, it was literally just Pete and I. And then almost every year, I would say there's been about 100% growth in employees. So it just literally compounds every year so that we've hit hundreds upon hundreds of employees. And I started having to be a jack of all trades. So I had to know, Pete and I had to know every single position of every machine because we were stitching the gis. You know, it was Pete and I sitting down at the sewing machines, actually stitching every gi, to the point now where there's teams of people doing the things that Pete and I used to do, and they can do it way better than we ever could. And I'm proud of that.
You guys still get to hang out? Are you still bros?
Oh, Pete just walked by my office.
I mean, are you guys working like 90 hours a week?
Some it's give and take. Some weeks yes, some weeks no. We're going into our busy season now. So, you know, being a company that makes jeans and gis and hoodies and hunt, you know, everyone wants that stuff going into the cold weather and the holidays.
How do I ask this question? Because I want an honest answer.
Okay.
I'll ask it this way. What steps are you taking to make sure the people who are stitching for you now are happy? And I'd like a no bullshit answer.
So we started off when we were trying to grow, saying, you know, the biggest thing at Origin is the culture. So if you walk through, every single person is smiling and usually happy and they're very excited. And when you walk through other factories, you don't see that. But for the longest time, we weren't competitive in our wages because we were still an up and coming company. You could go to McDonald's and get the same pay as you could, but you weren't getting treated the same. And over the last couple of years, we could have grown financially and said, okay, we're going to buy this new building, we're going to buy this. But we decided to invest back in the people and give more money back to the employees so that we're one of the higher paying jobs. You know, and you can come straight out of high school and there's no background required. And so people can actually look at it as a career. There isn't many jobs like that anymore where you can
farm it, particularly where your factories are, right?
Right, yeah. Exactly. Here it used to be we had the mills. So people would come straight out of high school and go work at a paper mill, and you could have a lifelong career and do well and retire. But all those mills are shutting down.
Right. What a gift, man. What a gift to our sport. What a gift to your town, to our country. I'm excited to watch and see what happens next. How much are you training jiu-jitsu right now?
Right now, not a whole lot.
Just this episode is never going to air.
This one is because I'm listening to my body. I have a torn Achilles and a separated rib right now.
How did you get a separated rib?
White belts. I'm telling you. I was teaching a white belt how to do a knee slice pass, and he got past, and then he went to stand up and tripped and fell and dropped his knee right on my ribs.
John Danaher says that 80% of the injuries that happen in jiu-jitsu come from body weight being dropped recklessly on another person.
That's 100% what it was.
That's a bummer. All right, so you're not training that much. How long ago did your friends get their black belts?
About year and a half, 2 years ago.
Oh, dude, you're going to get your black belt.
It's.
You think you were going to get it at camp this year?
I don't know. It's one of those
things. That's a yes.
It doesn't surprise me anymore. You know what I mean? It's just going to be one of those things when it happens. I'm going to be surprised, because there was many times I'm like, this is it. You know what I mean? So now it's going to be one of those things. When it happens, it happens.
I've told the story so many times. I was so psyched. I was so eager to get my blue belt. And when I had it in my head, like a half dozen different times, I had it in my head. This is the day. I know this is the day I'm getting it. And it never was. It was never that. It was never that day. Dude, I would love to. I feel like this is a good place to wrap. And at the same time, I feel like we could talk for days. What did I miss? Describe your game. What are you working when you do get to train? What are you working on, and what are you good at, and what are you missing
in your jiu-jitsu? What most people get surprised about with me is being such a big guy is that I'm a bottom game player.
Yep.
Is that I want you to feel like you're on ice. I want to be underneath you, and that there's just, you don't feel comfortable anywhere. And then that's when I sweep you, come up on top, and submit.
Okay. And where don't you want to be ever? What do you hate? Even at brown belt, or even at almost, let's call you almost black belt.
That's a good question. I mean, like anyone else, I don't like being in bottom inside control. You know, having someone that's always the biggest struggle is, you know, there's certain people I will almost let them get to mount because I can get out of it easier than them just parking in side control.
Yep. Yeah, I'm totally with you. I'm struggling in side control with this one particular guy, Russian Alex. I talked about him last week. He's a new blue belt, and he's strong as an ox. But I made a little progress with you today, Russian Alex. If you're listening, and I know you are, I made a little headway today. But man, it's so hard. It's so rewarding.
100%. But my game ever since white belt has always been I start in guard. Even with black belts, I knew I was going to get destroyed, but I always just started in guard. And still to this day, you know, with black belts, they're like, where do you want to start? I'm like, I'll start, you know, in guard. You know what I mean? So they'll come into my guard. And I'm like, all right, here we go. I'm going to either get better or learn.
That's it. Those are our two choices. Get better or learn. And I mean, and you're getting better even when you're learning. Of course you
are.
Bro, thank you so much for coming on the show. I'd love to have you back on at some point in time. And, you know, yeah, when people buy things from Origin, it does. It supports your company. It supports my work that I'm doing here. But I truly am honored and grateful. And I could be hawking a lot of things on the show. But they would be things that I don't use, that I don't care about. And I'm like legitimately proud of I'm grateful for our new friendship that we're building. And I'm legitimately proud to be associated with Origin and Jocko Fuel. Okay, so that was a conversation with John Milan. That was our first Origin story. I hope you liked it, and I hope that you will support Origin. Listen, like we said in the episode, you don't have to be American to appreciate American quality. You could literally be anywhere in the world and pick up a pair of boots or a gi or jeans and be excited about buying stuff that is supporting people that work in very happy, safe, healthy circumstances and rocking out some top quality gear. I appreciate you being here. This has been My White Belt. I am, as always, your host, Jim Trick. Train hard, train smart.